Thank you very much to Monica, Marisela, and Fiona for your presentations. I think there are several points we could start in the discussion. I mean, this conversation after the presentation is also for you to give space to react on each other's presentations. I think there were one thing where things come together is the community-based management of cultural production versus the IP, intellectual property system, and what happens in this, where those come together, where those interface, and how we can manage this. But then there was also the notion of tradition, and is it, how helpful is it, what to call tradition, and what's behind it, and those I think are the two like broad lines I could make out of all your presentations. Should we maybe start with the latter, because you talked about the concept of tradition, which I think came mostly in your two presentations.
For me, it's really important that we also have tradition. We always had in our historical development, we always had part of tradition. But the concept itself was developed just when the idea that we are modern arose. And it's really interesting that part of our cultural production was more or less excluded, or was perhaps excluded for the IP model of a market society. Part of it, the folklore, was modeled outside of economic exploitation, actually studied by scholars, anthropologists, preserved by museums, and actually named as cultural heritage. And the other part of music, the IP part of music was actually handled in a IP model from the beginning on global market for sheet music, and after that for records and radio music and so on and so on. So my question is now a little bit, what should we do? Are these parts still aside from each other, or are they just more hybrid now, that or have they never been as apart as we perhaps think? And I would be interested in your positions on that, whether this this idea, we have one part which could be exploited by the international market, and we have the other one which perhaps shouldn't be exploited, where the people have the rights to defend their property rights. What do you think?
Okay, I think you've raised quite a number of interesting issues. I'm good. But one of the things, when you're talking about tradition, and sometimes I find it very difficult to use that particular word, tradition. If I take the example of just when you talk about music, you have music and then you have world music. Why would we have those different categories in the first place? So in the same way, when we're looking at all these issues of traditional cultural expressions, I think the initial idea was when you're talking about traditional cultural expressions, they're basically defined as expressions which have been handed over from generation to generation. They're basically oral. They do not know who the author is and all those things. But I think from the various studies that we've done, you find that that is not necessarily true. The authors, if you look deeply into the community, you'll be able to know whom the author is, especially when it comes to the music. Because you had specific people, not just like in contemporary music, not all of us would like to sing, but most of us basically just sing in the shower so that people don't hear. But you have that creative element. So the thing is that I think at that point in time when we were talking about traditional cultural expressions, we were trying to fix it into the existing notions of intellectual property. So you're looking at it in terms of copyright, because you can even see from the history that Monica has given us in terms of where the discussion started off, especially more so in the 70s with the UNESCO issue. But the thing is that I don't think that is the approach that we need to be looking into. We need to look at these works as creative works on their own merit. So it's not an issue of talking about, yes, it's tradition. And as I said, you find something is traditional, but it's traditional in as far up to a particular point in time. And even right now, when you find what it is that's coming out, unfortunately, there are quite a number of clips that I had done, but due to some technical issues, I lost my entire presentation. But I wanted to show you now the first clip that I showed you would be the closest we have to the traditional, because you'd find that the music that the person was playing is some, you'd find that there are songs which were actually performed by the Luo community. The second one is contemporary to the extent that this person, all he did was use the traditional instrument, but he still, I mean, had that traditional tune, so to speak, but that particular work of his would still fall squarely within the protection of intellectual property because he's composed it, it fits into all those requirements of copyright. And then the final one, again, it was outright. You could see that this is she's nicknamed Anyango. This is a name from the western part of Kenya. And she has been able to compose her own music after spending, it was a couple of years in this particular, one of the cities in Kenya called Kisumu, learning this particular instrument. So the question is, would that be traditional music? Yet it has been composed specifically by Anyango from Japan, using the traditional issue. So I think it's pertinent, it's very important that we define what we actually mean and we know exactly what it is that we're seeking to protect.
Well, thank you very much to both of you for these great presentations. So I was thinking during the presentation, so why do I dislike this word traditional so much, bearing in mind that you both reflected on it? And of course, it's not that I dislike the word traditional at all. Of course, it might have some negative connotations in completely other circumstances, but I started to get to develop this this sense of frustration with it because it's been used to marginalize people. And the reason I say that is because, without wanting to get into a long discussion about what cultural creativity is, although it's a very interesting discussion, some of which we had in earlier sessions, culture is traditional. That is what culture is. It's building on things that go before. So this comment, I think, that, you know, in some senses that you're making, you know, that we're all both traditional and modern, you know, in a sense this false dichotomy between the traditional and the modern, the traditional and the contemporary is part of the problem that we're dealing with here. And it's also very interesting to think about how power relations between the West and the rest of the world also play out here. Why do we think it's important, for example, in Kenya, to look at these questions? Well, it's also a part of the general disempowerment of Kenyan musicians and creators and so forth that makes us think maybe some special protection is necessary. And I don't disagree with that. But I think the problem that we have to face up to here, and I was reflecting, Martin Kretschmer made this really interesting comment about how law's made, and he said it's not made because lawyers start trying to fiddle around inside the rules and find new ways to do things. That's not how you change the system. You change the system because the system is fundamentally unable to reflect who you are, and I think that's true. So the system is changed from the outside generally, even though there are movements inside the system. But I think the other problem that we have with this system of intellectual property and cultural heritage that we're living under now is that law also shapes the way you perceive the world. So you stop being able to think outside the boxes. We've got a system of cultural heritage protection. We have international treaties on intangible cultural heritage, but most lawyers, not other people, but most lawyers find it very hard to think of those things as having an overlap. And part of that reason is what's known of as a sort of a system problem in law, which is intellectual property rights are private property rights. And cultural heritage is part of international law. They're not private rights. You can't enforce them as an individual, which I think is correct, but it's also hard to enforce them in any court as a community. So we've got a problem where, in a sense, perhaps I can refer to one other thing that's also gone before, which is, of course, it's the needs of capital accumulation which has driven this particular system. That's not because authors' rights are driven by capital accumulation, but the imbalance of the copyright system in favour of those who invest money in creation and distribution instead of the creative people who make the music is, in a sense, a reflection of the society that we live in. Okay, so that's the society we live in. So I think that one of the things that we need to do a little bit, and my suggestions are really, we need to start thinking outside the box that the existing legal systems have made for us. Instead of trying to think always inside them, start trying to look outside them and pose the questions, which are really important questions, about cultural creativity and cultural production in a way which is a little bit different.
But in an ideal world, if we want to imagine it, the law could actually help to bring forward the developments in that way. And my question is now, can the copyright law or an organization like WIPOS, is it still capable to be the table where these discussions are, or should we, should, for example, Kenya leave the table in Geneva?
can I just say to that, and then I'll let Marisa, that, I mean, I don't want to express an opinion on that at the moment, but exactly on whether WIPOS, but what I would say is that we need to, my argument would be we need to turn the question right round, and we need to say, if we think the protection of, if we want to call them traditional cultural expressions, important, why don't we think it's important for all of us? How did we get to a stage where jazz musicians and hip-hop musicians and all the rest are not able to, in a sense, engage in what's a community practice of creativity without stepping on other people's toes? So I think my question would be more, I mean, forum is also constraining. So it's not just the law that constrains, but as we said before, the administrative practices and the forums in which law is made also constrict our thinking. But my own view is not, I mean, I don't know what the ideal world is, but my own view is that we need to rethink this question altogether. We need to think much more about if it matters to create, protect community forms of cultural creation. And this doesn't mean getting rid of private intellectual property rights, but if it matters to protect them also from privatization, as in the argument that Marisela, then we need to look at the question from an entirely different perspective.
So would you suggest rather to talk about community-managed cultural production instead of traditional? And how would that be helping, for example, in the case of Kenya?
I guess you've just asked the question in a different way, but the question is, I think one of the biggest issues is the privatization of what would be perceived to be community property, and one of the things we need to do is to go back and not really go back, but to re-examine the existing systems. Like both Fiona and Monica have said, one of the biggest problems we have is actually the existing legal system. And I was saying, like, for instance, in our constitution, the cultural, traditional cultural expressions are recognized as such. But the problem is, in terms of the hierarchy of the laws, if you're going to be looking at any pre-existing systems that were there, you find that you have the constitution, you have the written laws, you have the precedents, you have all these other issues, and then somewhere at the bottom, on issues which are not dealt with any other law, you have the customary laws. And you find that in most cases, they're normally applied very selectively. And I think this is something that we've picked up from the post-colonial period, whereby the laws, you know, what would happen is, if you're looking at the history of any of the countries, including Australia, Canada, who were colonized by the British, what they do is come and ask you to discard whatever it is that you had, and then they impose this particular system. And it's very sad, when it comes to the IP system, it was applied selectively. So mainly it was the subjects of the Her Majesty who would be, it would apply in particular in Kenya. So you'd find that the issues when it comes to the existing systems that they had then slowly disappeared. then there's this particular vacuum that has been created. So we have this cultural goods, so to speak, the cultural works, and we do not have a very specific system. And then what happens now is that we end up thinking in terms of existing intellectual property systems. As I said, if you look at our traditional knowledge act, it very much mirrors the Copyright Act when you're talking about the rights that are being dealt with. So it's something that we need to rethink. Yes, we have all these systems, but what is it that we can do from what existed? What can we learn from the communities in terms of protecting or in terms of preservation? Because I think for most of them, it was an issue of preservation and facilitation. And as I said at the beginning of my presentation, is that you'd find that when it comes to music, the music was specifically, there's a specific system of using the music. So if it is a song that has been composed for, let's say, a wedding, that's basically all that you're going to use that particular song for. So you're not going to go and use it for another party somewhere for something completely different. So there were very specific rules in terms of how you're going to deal with this. And they were given recognition. So they were recognized as the people within that particular community who, if you wanted music composed, you'd go to that particular person. So of course, it was not, we did not have it recorded then, but right now, as time goes by, you find that people are recording it. So you're able to access it. We have various groups who have ended up commercializing that. So you have what you can pinpoint as folkloric music of traditional lullabies, which have been commercialized. But the question is, what are they being used for? So we need to re-examine what systems we had before and see how best, or even for the few vestiges where you still have the strong cultural attachment, so to speak, we can actually learn from them and see how best we can be able to deal with this particular music. Because I don't think it is an issue of keeping it to myself, but it is an issue of being able to disseminate it and probably giving the recognition that is deserved from the people or from the community where it came from.
One thing you have also always, you have all talked about was what can we learn from the communities for law in general, like how to deal with community-based cultural management, like some, what can be community rights to culture?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the, this is exactly the example of how law, and you know, I'm a person from from settler Australia, and from therefore the Western legal mainstream, how it constrains your own way of thinking about the world. Because one of the reasons that I wanted to emphasize this line in the Yothu Yindi song, that planting the Union Jack didn't change our law at all, is that one of the other things that happens in the confrontation between Western legal systems and these people that we want to marginalize as somehow traditional or indigenous, or you know, indigenous is correct, but as traditional or in some way non-Western, while forgetting they also live in the Western world. One of the things is that we show actually very little interest in what their laws were on these questions. The communities themselves fought and resist this suppression of their own law. So in a sense, we've got very interested in Australia, for example. We're very interested these days in the indigenous culture, in inverted commas, that is westernized settler Australians, are very interested in identifying themselves by indigenous culture. We're much less interested in knowing actually about what are the legal norms of communities, how might you find them out. Of course, there are anthropologists who've worked on this, but this is something that hasn't really penetrated into much legal discourse. In fact, there's a really another interesting thing I was reflecting while listening to Monica's paper, is that this whole trajectory of the use of the word tradition and modern, contemporary, in a kind of sociological and historical cultural sense, seems to be completely at odds with the trajectory of the law. And one of the interesting questions is, you know, why even in Western society the law develops along a pathway which doesn't seem to respond to many of the debates and concerns, which in fact are happening in other kind of systems, even within Western society. So, but anyway, getting back to the point, I think that the members of Yothu Yindi, really interesting group, because the lead singer is a younger brother of an elder of the clan, and all of their use of community images, dance routines, music, musical styles, reproduction of artistic works was all considered to be in accordance with community law, so it's reported. And yet, I don't know of any Western intellectual property scholar, including myself, who's really asked, well, why? How are they? How did that match up with the private intellectual property rights that the band also had in the extremely successful music that they produced?
I think one of the interesting things, again, that came up from Monica's presentation is the whole issue of the realization that there's actually a value in the traditional cultural expressions, to use that particular term. And you find it's because for a very long time, these works were used within, as I said, communities for specific purposes. But I think the whole question of protection has basically come about because of the commodification or commercialization of these particular works by third parties. So the argument can come either from the communities or the government itself. So you find that the communities would say, this particular music has been used, we have not been compensated. They have not recognized us. So is there a system that we can put in place so that we are able to deal with the issue of commercialization of these particular works? So for quite a number of them, they'll say, it's not that we're refusing. We'd like you to access it. We'd like many people to use that particular music. But the question is, what do we get as the community? And I think, unfortunately, that is very close to what it is that you have under the intellectual property rights system. But before then, when there was not much of an issue of commercialization, that's why prior to that, it wasn't that much of a big deal. But with the whole globalization and access to these particular works, you'll find that you get to hear of some music which basically sounds very similar to, you know, some community in central Kenya. It's being played somewhere in California or something like that. The question is, what happens? So even recently, I think we had one of the artists coming in and they wanted to see if they could be inspired by the local music. They're looking for a new sound. So those are the issues that I think have actually pushed people to sit down and rethink and ask whether or not, because prior to that, nobody was that keen because you already had systems because of the scope and the place where this particular music was used. But now it has gone global. So I think those are some of the issues that we'll be looking into.
Yeah, perhaps I would like to remind too that we perhaps should also look not only as we already said, not only on the international law level or the nation state law level, but also at other bodies which are really important for our questions, for example, the collecting societies, all these intermediaries which have a long tradition of also racial script or cultural script. I just can tell you a historical example of that. The collecting societies, from its beginning on, they had classifications and rules how to diffuse the money, and it was really a biased system. It was a system which was better for composers with scores and was really bad for the oral tradition, and it was really good for successful artists. And we have also to acknowledge that this whole copyright system, this with the admin, as already mentioned, is a star system. It's actually really good for the holders of copyrights who have many, many works in their portfolio, or for enterprises with many artists with many works. So my question would be a little bit how to deal with this what could be a bridge of this local, this, I can see it, we have a local level of norms and laws, and we can handle that, but how do we handle this global music market with this local notions? And I don't have a solution, I'm a historian, but I would be interested in what could be bridges between these local norms and this global universal norms, because that's what the market wanted. Global norms you can trust, you know how to negotiate, you don't have to negotiate for each case individually, you have just the global contract. And how to handle that between these global contracts and these local practices? What to do?
Well, that's an enormous question. I don't think there's anything wrong with this in a sense being driven at an international law level, because in the, you know, the world we live in a sense, you know, there's an argument that whether you want to argue that the nation states are withering away or not, there's an argument that in fact we live in a kind of a global culture as well, and so a degree of common legal principles governing our relationships with the way we use cultural production and cultural creativity, you know, has got a lot going for it. I think that for me is not so much of a problem. I think more the problem is that we've become extremely past dependent on the sort of private property rights nature of intellectual property. But it's not just that, it's also because intellectual property itself has intensified, as we heard in the last panel, it's intensified over time. As Martin Kretschmer was saying, you know, the idea that every composer has to be thinking about copyright law instead of composing music, reflecting because the idea of reflecting basic elements in the culture around you has now become so tied up with legal rights, you know, it should really be a question of concern. So I think, but my real argument is that the whole post-colonial condition is that we want to always see these non-Western ways, as we see it, of making culture. I'm not sure, but as we like to see it, non-Western ways, we want to always see them as other. We're not prepared to see them as part of a kind of a global mainstream way of addressing this really serious question between, and because this is not an inherently anti-copyright position, it's an absolutely reasonable that individuals have some types of rights over things that they produce and contribute to our collective culture. I don't think that's a, well, for me that's not really in dispute here. The real question is how we find this balance and how we as a community can defend a certain line beyond which we say, okay, it's not all right to commodify or privatize. And I think that's the, and we're so unwilling to look outside this kind of path-dependent capital accumulation-driven model that copyrights become, that my suggestion is really the simplest one, that it's driven us to a position where we've privatized so much of our culture and we have so little sense. It's incredibly impoverishing in a creative sense for Western society to believe that we have no traditional culture and there's not rights in culture that we all should have. That's incredibly impoverishing cultural idea. And so perhaps it's not a ridiculous idea to look to places where people still believe that to see other models that we could use.
Perhaps just, I think that's also part history can take in this, that we can remind. There were periods, for example, in the late 60s, in the 60s, where nation state in the global south, but also cultural anthropologists, people from the folklore scene in the US, they were thinking about alternative paths and there were discussions about it. And it's really important that we remind we took that path, but there were alternatives. And it's always, I think it's always really important that we think about alternatives. And for me, sometimes law, it's a problem because you think there are no alternatives. You have a really strong bundle of knowledge, which with the long experience, which gives you a lot of trust for the future. And this is really difficult, how to think in alternatives with this really strong tradition in law.
So law turns out to be a bit like neoliberalism then, you know, there is no alternative. But I think that something that's very interesting though is how it precisely, I said for this reason, it shapes how we think. In Joe's really interesting, fantastic presentation, the first question that he asked us when he asked us to listen to music was, do you think they're copied? Okay, that's not the same question as do you think they sound the same, but it's a question, of course, the question is shaped by the legal environment in which we live. So when I wasn't sure whether they'd copied, it was because I didn't know whether they came up with the same thing by themselves or... So you've got a... You have this way in which all of this apparatus of law so much shapes the way you think. And it's not easy to step out of that, but my argument is, okay, we actually have got examples where we can see people stepping out of it, so why not use them?
Do you have suggestions, like concrete suggestions for this kind of community rights? And also one thought I also have was that, yes, we can think in our culture, we have also community-based culture and so on, but in the case of, I think, the indigenous communities, there are also like power relations in place that also require some certain type of protection, or some, it's another dimension, I feel, also that comes into play.
I guess it's one of those situations where we literally have to think without the box. In this particular case, if you're looking at the community rights, so to speak, is how best can we facilitate, still go back to the issue of facilitate, preserve, and then avoid the misappropriation. It might not necessarily be within the existing intellectual property law. You can have very specific laws that safeguard the interests of the community as a whole. So the thing is that I guess for many people, when you talk about the rights, it's always based on an individual. But here, the thing is that we're looking at a collective, because as much as there's one particular person who did it and they were recognized as such, because it's something that has gone on over the years, you'd find that it is the community that is recognized as such, and we need to come up with systems whereby we recognize and use that particular work only for the use that they want us to use it for. So we do not go beyond what I'd put in parentheses, the traditional use of that particular work. And I think one of the issues that we're discussing, and I'm not too sure whether Fiona would agree with me on this one, is the issue of the traditional knowledge commons. Because it offers a system whereby, you know, the work is out there, we get to know which community or who's the custodian of that particular work. And if we need to commercialize it or do whatever it is that we need to do with it, we know whom to go to, and we know they can tell us what it is that they can allow us to do with that particular work. So it's not very prescriptive, but it gives the communities the freedom to get into contractual relationships and decide how best that particular work can be used. And I think that way we avoid the pitfalls of either issues of originality, issues of authorship, issues of time-bound protection. So basically you recognize that they do have these particular works which they're custodians of, and then you let them decide how you're going to engage in terms of using that particular work. That's the closest I can think about.
Thank you, Maricela, for giving me a chance to say something about the commons. So just to say about this, and this is an example of doing what you said and trying to think out of the box, the commons is a highly valorized space, cultural and political space. Given that it's so valorized and we make so much of it, it's really remarkable to think that in terms of cultural production, it's entirely created by intellectual property. So the intellectual property says what's in and out of the commons. It's an absence. The commons is an absence of intellectual property rights at the moment. So my argument would be, if we really believe in this place, the commons, maybe we need some positive rights to defend it that don't just depend on the intellectual property system. So it's not so much that I disagree with what you said, as to say that I don't, the commons, having this idea that the place where you resist intellectual property is created by intellectual property seems to me a little quaint.
But I think it's the when you're talking about the traditional knowledge commons, as much as it's based on the commons idea, it's very specific. So I think it's different from the knowledge commons that you have under intellectual property. So it's very specific to traditional knowledge. Just creating that particular space where people can actually access and get into the necessary contractual relationship. So it doesn't work on the assumption that there was an intellectual property. It already recognizes that this is work that is owned by a particular group of people, or rather they're the ones who are holding it, but we are trying to be able to allow for access and at the same time documentation and archiving. So it might not necessarily be issues of positive protection, it could be more of defensive, whereby you have a database and everything to basically guide people so that if you want to use that particular work, you know whom to go and talk to. Yeah.
We have, I think, time for one or two questions.
Yeah. Thank you all very much. My question is about copyright and the digital world now, and especially what's happening in the EU with new digital laws being written and the rest of the world that will follow. Will the digital world, will it give us maybe, does it give us the opportunity to really break down copyright and copyright as something that has become kind of perverted, something so overdeveloped? It's copyright law is too complex, it's totally untransparent, and yeah, in our overdeveloped society, will the digital world and the new laws, how can we break it down and actually get into a system, maybe that's better? Do you see this opportunity happening now? Also because the digital world will become one world, one law, and not the geopolitical anymore.
Well, if I can just say about that, so sometimes it's, you know, there are some advantages in getting a bit long in the tooth and having been around for a while. So I can remember in 2000 making a presentation where I talked a lot about commodification and corporate ownership of culture, and everyone said, this is 2000, so it's a little while ago, and at a conference in Rotterdam, and everyone said, oh no, but the internet comes and it's going to democratize everything and everything will be okay. And then we know what happened, of course, that then precisely because the digital world is a vast space, the role of intermediaries still stayed important. And intermediaries, in fact, found a new way to deal with it, new business models to deal with the various problems that that the kind of lack of a complete interface between copyright and digitization had provided. It might be that the digital, I mean, it's hard for me to know. I'm horrified to hear that you think that we're going to get the same version of EU law everywhere in the world. That's really even worse than having it in the EU. So, it could be. It's really hard to predict. I mean, what we have to understand is that the interests of capital will use intellectual property rules only for so long as it matters to them. So, despite all the endless assertions about intellectual property being someone's property, being a right, being all those things, that's only because it served the intermediaries industry, by which I mean the commodifiers, production houses. It served them well to this point, but as soon as they find another business model, I guess they'll leave it, and in fact there are some signs of that already, and there'll be people like me still who have been around forever saying, well, actually there is some value in intellectual property rights for individual creators. So I think that we shouldn't assume that the arguments that these rights are so fundamental and essential to the kind of industries that are built up around creative behavior will always sustain copyright. They'll sustain copyright for as long as there's not a better way of generating value of creativity. That's a really depressing thing to say, but I think it perhaps is true.
Yeah, I think I would completely agree. At the beginning, there was this whole discourse about sharing of everything. And here again, I think it's really important to look at not only at the law, but also at all the bodies which negotiate actually the collection of the money and the redistribution of the money. And it's not all regulated by law. Most of it is negotiation, and negotiation is always, bargaining power, and I think the term bargaining power is really important in that question. Who has the bargaining power more or less sets the rule, and I think we shouldn't talk only about, somebody already said it, about the law, but also about the economy, about the contracts, about the bargaining power in this whole game.
Okay, I think we have to wrap up. On that note, thank you very much, Monica, Fiona, and Marisela, for your contributions. And you can all stay, because Larissa Mann is coming for her presentation and keynote right after.